This episode of the CE Drive podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the life insurance licensing program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Today's episode will be good for continuing education credits in all jurisdictions. One notable exclusion here will be for those in Alberta. You won't be good for accident and sickness credits from today's episode. There's not enough accident and sickness content for this to qualify for an ANS credit, but it will be good for life insurance credits in Alberta and in all jurisdictions, and it will also qualify for a financial planning credit from the Financial Planning Standards Council. In today's episode, we have two interviews from two Edmonton-based financial planners. Both are going to talk about the decision as to when to take Canada Pension Plan, whether it should be taken early or whether it's taken at age 65 or whether it's taken at age 70. We're going to first hear from Kent, and Kent is going to discuss something that actually Kent and I talked about quite a while ago, and that is the potential for a conflict of interest when the decision comes up for a financial advisor to recommend the appropriate time to take Canada Pension Plan. There's a lot more that we talk about, but it was really that conversation that led me to invite Kent as a guest on the podcast. And then we're going to talk to Marshall, and it was fortuitous. Just before recording this podcast, Marshall had sent me over some information that he had done up in his office, and it'll be available in today's show notes, this chunk that Marshall had done up that supports some of the math that I had previously done around Canada Pension Plan. You have to be really careful about this, though. As Marshall and I discuss in the episode, we can do all the math we want around Canada Pension Plan, but in the end, the decision is often not a mathematical decision. Before we get into the interviews, I'm going to cover off some foundational concepts similar to what we've done in past interviews. I'd like for people to have a little bit of familiarity with the underlying concepts before we delve into this. Following Kent and Marshall's interviews, I'll go through this in a little bit more technical detail, some of the particular items that they've touched on. The thing that I find most people not that comfortable with starting off is just how Canada Pension Plan benefits are calculated. Now, as some of you will be aware, Canada Pension Plan is undergoing a significant set of changes over the next 7 years. However, I'm going to, at least for now, deal with Canada Pension Plan as it is right now in 2019. Today, 2019, Canada Pension Plan has a year's maximum pensionable earnings of $57,400. That's the most income that you can earn and have to participate in the Canada Pension Plan. Basically, what this means is somebody who makes $57,400, or somebody who makes $70,000, or somebody who makes $100,000, all participate equally in the Canada Pension Plan. Now, this is going to change right away here, but all of those folks will contribute the same 4.95% of their base income to the Canada Pension Plan. That amount, though, that 4.95% that everybody is kind of comfortable with, actually starting in 2019, so starting this year, we see that amount increase to 5.1%. And that amount will gradually increase so that by 2023, that amount will be up to 5.95%. And I'll talk more after Marshall's interview about some of the other changes we see associated with that increased rate of contributions. Regardless, what happens then is when we're figuring out somebody's Canada Pension Plan benefit, we have to look at their contributions for their entire contributory period. For the vast majority of people, this would be true for somebody who was born and raised in Canada or somebody who came to Canada later in life, for the vast majority of people, your CPP contributions are calculated from the age of 18 until the point when you are starting to receive a benefit. If you have somebody who is retiring at age 65 then, that's 47 years of contributions. 65 minus 18, that's 47 years. If then I have somebody who, for that entire 47 years, always earned at or above YMPE, that year's maximum pensionable earnings figure, which as I mentioned is $57,400 in 2019, that person would, at age 65, qualify for the maximum Canada Pension Plan benefit. Now, we'll talk about some adjustments that get made to that in a moment. If, on the other hand, I have somebody who, from age 18 to 65, on average, earned about 60% of YMPE for that entire 47 years, then at age 65, that person will retire with a Canada Pension Plan benefit that's about 60% of the maximum. And the maximum CPP benefit for 2019 is $1,155 per month. So my person who was at the maximum level all the way along is looking at about $1,155 of monthly Canada Pension Plan benefit in 2019. My person who was at about that 60% level is going to be at about $680 a month of CPP benefit. Then if I have somebody who came to Canada later in life, let's say I have somebody who emigrated to Canada at the age of 40, and that person made good money from the time they emigrated to Canada from age 40 on to age 65, well, they have 25 years of good contributions and 22 years of no contributions. So a little more than half, let's call it 55%. That person would retire if they had income at or above YMPE for that period from age 40 to age 65. That person would retire with a benefit of about 55% of the maximum. And that same calculation, or that same type of calculation, applies to any CPP benefit. Let's say, for instance, we have somebody who becomes seriously disabled at the age of 50. That person at the age of 50 would have a 32-year contributory period from age 18 to age 50. That's 32 years. We would look at what their level of contributions was all along. If in that 32 years that person always earned at or above YMPE, now that person would have the maximum available benefit. If that person had earned only about half of YMPE during that period, then the variable portion of their disability benefit would be half what it could be. With disability benefits, there's a fixed amount. That fixed amount is about $500 per month. So everybody would get that base $500, but then the variable portion for the person who was at the maximum would be as much as it could be. The person who was about half of YMPE, they would get about half the variable portion. The net difference there is the higher income earner in that case would end up with about $1,200 a month of CPP disability, and the lower income earner in that case would end up with about $850 a month of CPP disability. Now, I had mentioned that there are some adjustments that get made. What happens is when you apply for a CPP benefit, any CPP benefit, there are three adjustments that get made. The first is the child rearing provision. Now, this is changing a little bit, and I'll actually explain this right now because it's easier to explain it right now rather than having to revisit the child rearing provision at the end of the call. So the way the child rearing provision works is if you have somebody, and it can be either parent, and if you have a separated parent situation, or if you've got parents who live together but they maybe do some tag team child raising where one of them does a year and the other does a year, or one does 3 years and the other is 4 years or whatever, what happens is you can take out up to 7 years per child. Now, it's not really 7 years per child. If you have two kids born 2 years apart, then you can take 9 years. You would take 2 years for the elder child and 7 years for the younger child. So up to 7 years, but if you have kids close together, it's not going to be 7 years. If you adopt, let's say you adopt a two-year-old, then you could take 5 years for that child up until the child's seventh year. So those years can come out of the calculation. Now, under the old rules, the way this works is we actually would just remove those years right out of your calculation as if they didn't exist. What's happening under the new rules is you'll have a choice here to opt in. What we can do is take the 5 years before you took time off to have a child and average that into your CPP contributions. This will work well for somebody who left a high-paying job to have a child and then sort of makes a gradual return back into the workforce. This new opt-in provision will help that person who takes that time off and sort of works their way back into the workforce. If you are earning the same level of income all the way along, then it doesn't really matter if we opt out or opt in. It's not really that consequential. That same calculation, incidentally, is being applied as well to CPP disability benefits, which is the second thing that you get pulled out. If you have a period where you were on CPP disability and now we're calculating another benefit, we're going to either ignore any time that you were on CPP disability or we're going to average in the 5 years before you went on to CPP disability. The third thing that gets opted out, so that's child rearing, any period of CPP disability, and the third thing that gets opted out here is your lowest 17% of your contributory period. For a 65-year-old, that represents 8 years. So if that person, let's say, took 8 years of going to school from age 18 to 25 and didn't earn great income during that time, that doesn't really hurt that person. Something we don't get into much in the interviews here is the decision to take early CPP and how that might impact a small business owner. One of the things that I go through quite a bit in my CFP classes is when you've got a business owner who's sort of 54, 55, 56 years old, that person will often already be maxed out on their CPP contributions. This is where continuing to contribute to CPP actually can be a waste because of that 17% dropout period. And it might be wise for the business owner to go to an all-dividend strategy just because they can save themselves the roughly $5,400 a year that the Canada Pension Plan otherwise takes from them. The color for today's episode is white. The color for today's episode is white. Let's now listen to what Kent has to say about the decision to take CPP early or late. Thanks very much for joining us today, Kent. We have Kent, who's a financial planner based in Edmonton. Kent is both securities and insurance licensed. Today, Kent and I are going to discuss something that we have talked about offline previously. We're going to talk a little bit about the decision to take Canada Pension Plan early or late. And Kent, do you mind going through the thought process that led you to the question you had originally posed around this?
I think that I just read it somewhere and wondering, you know, is there a conflict as an advisor? If we're saying to a client, well, you should take CPP early or late, if we're getting paid under management model and you're getting a fee based on that, if you're then saying to the client going, well, you should take the money out of your accounts here at XYZ firm, or you should look at taking CPP early. And I think that there definitely could be a conflict. You'd hope for the client that the advisor can get past that. And it also may make sense for the advisor to make sure that they're disclosing that to their client. You have to judge whether there's a conflict or not in the advice I'm giving you. But you still end up looking at much of the same pieces when you're deciding whether to take the CPP earlier. I mean, whether it's a male or a female, who's going to live longer, you know, in a husband and wife, or if you have health issues there. I mean, those are some of the other things that you're making your overall best guess with. You know, we can make all the assumptions and guesses that we want to do, but even if, you know, we say that the normal life expectancy is this, well, no one actually is normal. Everyone just is one side or the other of that average.
This would be somewhat analogous to the decision to take a commuted value from a defined benefit pension. And I think there that conflict of interest is well recognized. But I think you're right, Kent. I don't think that that idea has been explored much with the decision around early or late Canada pension plan. Can you maybe give some comment as to why the financial advice community hasn't focused on that particular conflict?
Maybe it's something that people hadn't necessarily thought of that much before. You know, but when you're trying to look at all the different places where there's potentially conflicts in working with a client, I mean, I think it's just, you know, another one of those things that has to be looked at. And again, I think with the majority of advisors out there, there's not going to be a problem with that. But it can get from a higher level. I mean, you could basically, you know, have an institution, you know, sort of depending on the level of advisors that they have. Are they, you know, are they in-house advisors? Well, then that might be something that's directed. And to say to people, okay, well, you'd take your CPP first without necessarily looking. I mean, you'd hope not again, but don't know what's out there.
It's a curious question. I don't know of anybody that has a policy, an across-the-board policy like that, but certainly you do still hear the rule of thumb, which was generally, I think, valid before 2012, that most people should take their CPP at age 60. I think that doesn't bear scrutiny today. I think that if you look at most circumstances, it makes sense for people to wait, although I know people who strongly support the value of the death benefit. There's another argument to be made there around waiting as long as possible to take it. I know a financial planner in Edmonton who crunches the numbers around the death benefit and very much shows that there's a value to take it early when you have two high earners. So every situation is different, obviously. Now, you raise a really good point here, Kent, that not just CPP, but in general, it can be hard to recognize where there is a conflict of interest. Do you have any thoughts as to how financial planner, financial advisor can better identify potential conflicts in their practice? Obviously, something triggered for you. You said maybe something you read.
Sometimes it is difficult. Quite often, there may be a conflict, but not in the advisor's mind. You know, in their mind, it's like, well, this is what you should be doing. And there's going to be times where they don't even think about what that conflict happens to be. And talking a little bit about business owners, well, you can't have, if you have one person who's selling a business, one person who's buying a business, even though it can be a parent and a child, both of them needs to have independent advice, really. There's certainly potentially conflict in there because what are they trying to do? Well, it'll depend on situation. You know, are they trying to maximize the value? And maybe that parent needs to have, you know, $1 million in order that they can retire. Well, then, you know, is that business worth $1 million? And to make sure that it is. I mean, normally with that type of situation, I mean, the parent is quite often giving their child a fairly good deal with things, but you don't know for sure.
And I think that it's not just the pricing sometimes that comes up there. I think sometimes the child might just not be aware fully of what they're buying. It might be a good deal sort of relative to the balance sheet, but not necessarily a good deal relative to how customers are going to react or relative to some other function of the business that's not so obvious. I think that's a good example of another potential conflict of interest. I don't know then if you have any other thoughts about how the financial planner can develop out their practice, let's say, to better recognize conflict. I think this is a difficult idea, one that bears a little bit of exploring.
Well, and I think sometimes it's stepping back to take a look at the business. And there's a couple things that a person could be doing. I mean, I'm sure you've, you know, seen people who have advisory boards. You know, there can be an advisor, but they've got an advisory board, and that advisory board is typically made up of clients. And it would be those people that you could bounce it off of. I mean, these are probably, you know, people who, you, if you brought them as a board in that way, you already respect them. Well, they might be able to bring some ideas that you hadn't thought of. So that would be one spot. I'm sure that the legal profession is a good place to go because they're, I'll say, more trained to look for conflicts. So to have someone look at your business, and then a person could probably find pieces of advice that they were given at some point, and that maybe there was a conflict there, even though one didn't necessarily notice it, but it still needs to be making sure that the client understands that that's there.
I think those are two really good examples. And I think we know that the Financial Planning Standards Council does put a fair bit of focus on conflicts of interest. At least two of the rules that the FPSC includes in their Standards Professional Responsibility mention very specifically conflicts of interest. And also it's one of IROC's regulatory priorities for their next regulatory cycle. So certainly I think everybody will benefit from improving their processes around identifying conflicts of interest. And yeah, those are two good, I think, actionable items. An advisory board or somebody that you can bounce an idea off of, that's certainly valuable. And yeah, this is another reason to have a good set of centers of influence, is that, you know, lawyers typically have been trained to identify this. That's a really good point, Ken. So yeah, thanks for, maybe I put you on the spot a little bit there, but for coming up with two good actionable items. Do you have any other thoughts, Kent, around this decision to delay Canada Pension Plan or take it early?
Only in sort of what you said earlier, it's far more difficult to decide on today than it was, you know, prior to the changes. I mean, before, it, yeah, like you said earlier, it was, if you could take it age 60, then go ahead and take it. You know, and that's for, you know, for business owners, they had that ability and to, you know, make sure show that their income was low enough to be able to do it. And so that worked really well. And the numbers generally you could, it certainly made sense, or certainly seemed to make sense. I don't think anyone even thought about, was there a conflict there? You know, in okay, well, you're not taking money out of your investments with whatever firm, you're taking money in a CPP. But, you know, there's still that, you know, is there longevity in the family and this type of thing? And one of the things I guess I will do, or certainly look at times, because this is an inexact science, unfortunately, because again, no one knows how long they're going to live. You'll only know at the end whether you made the right decisions. But I mean, does it make sense, or when you can, to, you know, hedge your bets, to have the, you know, the male take CPP earlier and then the female take it later, you know, just from numbers. I mean, they're expected to last longer. So it's something that, you know, it can be done in trying to hedge those bets. And then you'll also have some clients are going to feel very strongly that I want to get as much money out of the, from the government as soon as I possibly can. But it doesn't matter what numbers we show them. They are the boss, and their thought is going to, you know, this is what I have to do. Okay, well then, you know, that sort of trumps everything else.
That's the nature of what people hold dear, or people value, whatever the case is. Any last minute thoughts then, Kent?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah, thanks very much for sharing. That's an excellent example of a tangible conflict of interest, one that I think a lot of people will not have fully considered. And you've worked through, I think, some very practical considerations around that. I think that's a conversation there. Your thoughts on that, I think, will help all of the listeners out there to further develop their own practice as far as both specifically how they deal with Canada Pension Plan early and late decision, and also around conflicts of interest more generally in their business. So yeah, thank you very much, Kent. That's great.
Thank you.
Lots of good stuff from Kent there on that topic, and we explored some things that I don't normally go into in, let's say, CFP classes, which I always appreciate. We have our first iTunes review. I've been failing to ask for these, so thanks a lot to user Bert E. Roy or Bert Y. Roy. Bert was good enough to drop us a 5-star review. It says, Jason's a pro. Thanks, Bert. Jason's a great instructor, and the podcast is a good format for planning topics where discussion is essential. So if you like what you're hearing, drop us a good review at iTunes. If you don't like what you're hearing, drop us a review at iTunes. And we're early days, so still lots of lessons to learn here. I'd appreciate hearing from anybody who has a perspective to share. Thanks. You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College. bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up. And you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way. This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Before we get into Marshall's discussion, I wanted to just review a little bit around survivor's benefits for Canada Pension Plan. I find this is an area that a lot of people aren't really that comfortable with until they have some clients, or what I find is most common is until they have family members who actually are collecting CPP survivor's benefits. The CPP survivor's benefit is being simplified a little bit starting in 2019. Basically, what happens with CPP survivors is if you die and leave behind a spouse, if that spouse is the parent to your children, and this includes common law partner as well for this purpose, so you die, you leave behind a spouse or common law partner who is a parent to your children, and that person is under the age of 65, then that person is going to get a flat benefit, which is just under $200 a month, plus 37.5% of what would have been your retirement benefit. So that's, call it around 40% of the roughly $1,155 a month that CPP can pay. That's a $200 a month base benefit, plus up to about a $400 variable portion, which comes to about a $600 maximum survivor's benefit for the spouse when you die and leave behind that spouse under the age of 65. If there's no children at all, then you don't get the flat $200, then it's just the 37.5%. And there are a few other criteria to qualify. I don't want to get into those, but you have to have contributed to CPP for a sufficient period of time as well. That's going to have the greatest impact on new Canadians and people who are very young and relatively new to the workforce. Going back to the children's benefit then, if you die and leave behind dependent children, those children can receive a benefit of up to $250 per month, or just under $250 per month per child. That $250 is paid to the child, which can actually be a good thing. If the child is a minor, it actually gets added onto their parents' check, but it's taxed to the child. CPP benefits are all taxable, but we'd rather have them tax the child, who would have presumably a very low tax burden. This becomes a sort of effective income split. So about $250 per month per child, that amount is paid until the child is age 18, or until the child is 25 if they stay in school on a full-time basis up until age 25, or if you die and leave behind a child with a disability and that child was dependent on you while they were still a minor, then they can actually get that survivor's benefit, that roughly $250 a month. And all these benefits are indexed to inflation. They can get that roughly $250 per month paid for the rest of their life. If they were disabled and dependent on the CPP contributor who has died before that child was age 18. Once you hit age 65, or if you die and leave behind a spouse who is over the age of 65, so you have somebody who's been collecting that other CPP survivor's benefit for a while, or you've got, let's say, a 72-year-old whose spouse dies and leaves them a CPP survivor's benefit. And this is a big part of what Marshall talks about here, and it does touch on some of the stuff Kent discussed as well. If you've got somebody dies at that older age, or if we've got somebody who was collecting benefits and now they get to age 65, the benefit is recalculated at that point, and it's 60% of the deceased person's maximum benefit. However, that 60% is capped at the CPP maximum benefit. So if you've got two very high income earners or relatively high income earners, and one of them dies, they both waited, let's say, till age 65 to start collecting their CPP benefit, and they both maxed out that benefit, there will be little or no survivor's benefit there. And this can be a reason to start collecting earlier, because now you come up to your survivor's benefit a little bit, or you can come up higher from the base benefit you're collecting once you start to get that survivor's benefit. So it's potentially detrimental if you've got that scenario where you've got two good income earners and they both decide to wait until age 65 to start collecting. That being said, you'll hear Marshall in the discussion talk about longevity insurance, and I certainly bias in this direction. I'm a big fan of building in some longevity insurance here, which is something I'll discuss a little bit more after we hear from Marshall. With that, let's listen to what Marshall has to say about the decision to take the Canada Pension Plan. Thanks very much for joining us today, Marshall. It's great to talk to you.
It's great to be here, Jason.
Marshall is a private investment counselor based here in Edmonton and runs a firm that primarily deals in high net worth area. I think that's a fair summary, Marshall.
That's a very fair summary, Jason. Thank you.
So something you and I have chatted a little bit here and there about, and I know you've done some fairly in-depth analysis on, is the decision as to when to take Canada Pension Plan. I'm hoping, Marshall, you can take a couple of minutes and just talk about what led you to do that level of analysis that you've been good enough to share.
Yes, for sure, Jason. So a couple of months ago, we decided to do a little bit of math behind what would be the cumulative payments for an individual in Canada if they were to take the CPP earlier at the age of 60 and obviously take a lesser amount through this program, and then compare that cumulative payment to a scenario where they would take it at the typical age of 65 or delaying it now to the age of 70. So a number of years ago, the federal government has changed the metrics of the Canada Pension Program to encourage delayed payment. So they will give you more than the half 1% per month of delay like it used to be. And they are now penalizing to a greater degree people that take Canada Pension Plan earlier than the age of 65. So I was curious around what would be the crossover ages where an individual would have been indifferent between taking it between the ages of 60, 65, and 70, depending on the variable of their lifespan. So obviously, if somebody were to take the Canada Pension Plan payments at the age of 60 and die before they turn 65, then they made the right decision. But as one could fully be aware that there's a lot of variables between age 60 to, well, age 100, I guess, with regards to what can happen in one's life. And the first thing that we try to sort out was longevity and the value of these payments. So you were able to give that a review and saw similar results to some of the numbers that you were able to calculate.
Yeah, this is one of my Saturday evenings of nerding out with Excel, was running some Canada Pension Plan numbers. And yeah, you and I came to pretty similar conclusions. Some of the assumptions you use can obviously influence that. And pretty much every analysis that I've seen indicates that, at least based on one person's life, if there's any predisposition to longevity, that the age 60 decision hardly makes sense at all today. Would that be a fair summary, Marshall?
I don't think it is a fair summary. I would suggest that, as the old saying goes, a bird in hand is better than two in the bush. Some people might need to consider the value of that bird in the hand today and consider the likelihood of living beyond that. If we're looking at basic investment assumption of a 0% investment return and no inflation calculation into the mix, my numbers say that somebody has to live to the age of 72 for the decision between taking CPP at the age of 60 to 65 for it to break even. So definitely most people are going to live past that age of 72. If we look at typical lifespan numbers at either measuring at birth or measuring at the age of 65, we see that many people live beyond that, but lots of folks won't. So in our analysis, we make the case that for some folks, they may want to consider taking the Canada Pension Plan early if they think that it's better to get that money sooner rather than later.
Now, you show the sum values of the benefits. Could you show that to a client comfortably?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, our last available client newsletter, we wrote this paper and shared it with everybody.
And do you find people understand what those numbers mean? Was it shared in a way that people could come back to that and say, Marshall, I get what you're pointing to here, and I'm going to use this in my retirement planning decisions?
Good question, Jason. This is a new paper that was launched beginning of Q3 here, and I haven't had enough time to connect with people on this topic. My guess would be that I would need to shepherd the conversation with most of our clients on this topic. But having said that, there would be definitely a handful of clients that would be able to digest this type of information and wouldn't need any support from me.
Do you think then that given those numbers, just the raw numbers, the statistics generally support the decision to wait?
Yeah. If you're expecting a typical lifespan, waiting is in your benefit.
So I think the conventional wisdom here, Marshall, at least prior to the changes, has been to take your Canada pension plan as early as possible, prior to 2011. I think that's the decision the majority of people made. Do you think that that trend is changing, or do you think still the vast majority of people left to their own devices would start at age 60?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, Jason, but what I've seen in my practice is most people are looking at the age of 65. They're just kind of taking the typical age. But I would be curious to know what all of Canada is doing on their start date. Something I need to look into.
There's probably some information available about that. If I can track it down, I'll attach it to this episode. In your practice then, do you think that this level of research you've done would influence people's decision? Do you think it will cause people to wait until later? Or do you think that, you know, if the majority of your clients are already waiting until 65 to take it, do you think that it just gives a little bit more reassurance that that's the right decision?
Yeah, you know what, let me add, there's two things that I want to add to the conversation, and our paper highlights these few things. One would be the idea of your return on capital. So if somebody had the ability to take cash at 60 from the Canada Pension Program and reinvest it at really high rates of returns, the argument would be that it would be valuable to get those dollars sooner because your future value would be higher from getting those dollars through the program. So when we run different investment return assumptions, and in our example, we're working with returns ranging from 0% to 6%, we see the optimal age crossover ages move from 72 at a 0% rate of return all the way up to 79 at a 6% rate of return. So somebody has to live to 79 or older if they're able to turn their money over at 6% or more for their decision to be, I guess, incorrect. So by waiting to 65, they would have been better taking it earlier. I won't make any comments about what is somebody's investment rate of return assumptions, but obviously if it's a really conservative investor and they're just looking at T-bill returns or GIC type of returns, that would be pretty simple to measure. But if somebody has a much higher ability to earn returns, then the decision to take CGP earlier should be taken into account. The other thing I would like to comment on is the idea of taxes. And if the Canada Pension Plan is going to be integrated into a higher taxed Canadian's balance sheet, then potentially there's an argument that by taking Canada Pension Plan earlier at a lower amount will allow income to be smoothed out over a longer period of time. So again, there's lots of variables to look at here, but that could be an argument that one would make to taking it earlier.
Yeah, certainly in my own analysis, taxes have been the most complicated part of this, given that if you have somebody who's working later into retirement, you're taking Canada Pension Plan and you're losing, you know, half of it to tax potentially. And it's a hard calculation to get just right. You really have to know the specific client circumstances. The other thing that I found that you did a really good job of in your analysis and that I don't see sometimes taken into account well is the survivor's benefit. So maybe you can talk for a moment about how you talk to your clients about survivor's benefit.
Sure. So first of all, let me just give you a bit of an update on at least what I know about the survivor's benefit with the Canada Pension Plan. The government will top up the surviving spouse to the Canada Pension Plan benefit as at the age of 65 for the surviving spouse's total benefits. So if this surviving spouse took Canada Pension Plan at the age of 65, there will be no top up because they max out at that age. But if this individual would have taken Canada Pension Plan at the age of 60, then there is an extra 5 years of benefit that would be added on to this individual's pension plan. So the likelihood that both moms and dads are going to die at the same time is very unlikely. So you're getting a call option on your spouse's Canada Pension Plan, or at least 5 years of it, by taking Canada Pension Plan early. And I think this is another argument to taking Canada Pension Plan early for those that can see the math kind of tilting in that favor.
I certainly do see, and actually I know another financial planner based here in Edmonton who is a strong advocate for taking it early. She would also deal in a primarily high net worth environment, and she really places a lot of weight on that survivor's benefit. I do think that if the survivor's benefit is something that you attach so much importance to, then that does shift things in favor of the early decision.
Looking at numbers of pension plan survivors in Alberta, we're looking for a living spouse at the age of 75 that has a spouse die. We're looking at a lifespan of over 21 years. So getting that amount of extra Canada pension plan for a couple of decades is really valuable. And that's just working on average, right?
Again, I find that's a difficult area to do a good analysis on. To some extent, you're pulling out the crystal ball a little bit, but you know, that average 21 years of one spouse with an income by themselves, that's a useful bit of information. I like that, Marshall. What would be the age at which you could start this discussion with your client? Do you want to start having this discussion when clients are 50, 55, 59 and a half? Where's sort of the optimal time to set down this path?
One part of the conversation that we would look at is in our retirement planning, a lot of the clients that we serve don't understand the level of kind of these foundational benefits that are going to be provided by or through these government programs, Old Age Security, Canada Pension Plan. So just educating clients on what these amounts are and kind of reinforcing how the floor base of income is really conservative is I think a first step in developing a kind of a rich financial plan for our clients. After that is completed, I would suggest when our clients are in their late 50s or even getting close to 60, I mean, when the decision needs to be made, there's an impetus to actually getting the analysis done. And we would have a reminder in our contact management system that would remind us of certain critical ages, and age 60 is definitely one of them. So when we're reminded of that, we make sure that we get in touch with our clients and start having these conversations about decisions that need to be made around the Canada Pension Plan.
I do find it interesting that you primarily operate in the high net worth world. I think a lot of people who operate more in the middle income world would assume that the high net worth client wouldn't be so concerned about this decision, but it seems that there's really a very similar approach or attitude from your clients that you would find in, say, the middle income or mass affluent markets.
Absolutely. You know, somebody with a few million dollars in liquid assets still has significant risks that they need to know and understand with regards to their balance sheet and their spending plan. And if these moms and dads want to keep their spending at a $75,000 or $150,000 level, we need to make some hard decisions about what spending patterns need to be, what investment return assumptions should be made, and what risks need to be taken on the capital markets to try to get the returns needed to satisfy that portfolio requirement. For clients that have very small amounts of liquid assets in the low hundreds of thousands, it would be impossible to almost encourage somebody to take risks with that amount of money, just because getting it wrong would be so dramatic and so drastic for that person's outcome. Somebody with a couple million bucks, even though that's a lot of money in terms of what an average Canadian retiree would have, it's still not $20 million. I mean, that amount of money is still going to be required for possibly three decades. And it's not an amount of money that would get us out of needing to take an educated risk with.
Absolutely. It still requires the fundamental financial planning stuff that you're going to do with the person who has $200,000 of retirement assets or $2 million of retirement assets. Those are still not guaranteed enough assets to make it through retirement. If your spending is bad, or if you have a bad luck with investments in your first couple of years, or if you have kids who have extraordinary needs, yeah, all of those things can still hammer you. What about the concern, Marshall, about, I'm not suggesting there's any validity to this concern, the concern about the health of the Canada Pension Plan. Do you have clients that raise that issue?
It's come up in conversation, but I can tell you that I don't live there. It's not a concern that I share. And I think that the appetite for Canadians to support this program is going to be consistent for many decades. And I believe that we as a country will give plenty of notice for younger Canadians if we need to change the retirement assumptions. I don't believe that we're a country that would bait and switch workers to add dollars to this program to then not get them. And to be clear, we've seen some significant changes to the Canada Pension Plan program that's coming down the pipes, more requirements from business owners to pay into the program, and the ability for Canadians to continue with the Canada Pension Plan after normal retirement ages. So these are all efforts by our government to make this program healthier into the future.
I do agree, and I think you're on the same page here, that Canada Pension Plan currently is a strong program, and we should have comfort including Canada Pension Plan as it stands right now. And you point to the set of reforms that's now underway that'll be wrapped up by 2025. Younger folks will see benefit out of that expansion to the Canada Pension Plan. Do you have any last-minute thoughts, anything that's going through your head around Canada Pension Plan that you haven't had the opportunity to share, Marshall?
You know what? One area of planning that might be valuable to your guests would be the idea of longevity insurance. That idea is connected to the concept of the risks of somebody living a really long life and not having the financial assets to support their long life. Waiting to take CPP at the age of 70 is a practical way to insure against the longevity risk. So spend your own capital between the ages of 60, 65, up to 70, and then allow the Canada Pension Plan to come in as the cavalry to save the day if that particular mom and dad or individual in Canada doesn't have the retirement assets to provide for their standard of living at the age of 70.
Absolutely, Marshall. And if you're talking about longevity insurance, that's straight from the pages of Moshe Milevsky. I'll see if I can share some of his writings maybe to go along with the show notes, because there's some good stuff there. And I do agree that longevity in general is a risk that we underestimate today, that the direction that we're going, we're living significantly longer lives with long periods of significant morbidity in there as well. I definitely have a bias. I know this, Marshall, I have a bias towards later CPP for exactly that reason. I believe we underestimate that longevity risk. So I'm glad to hear you bring that up.
Good. I mean, I'm hoping your guests find some good nuggets of information from our talk on CPP today.
I think there's a lot of value to thinking through the problems associated with making the right decision about Canada Pension Plan. You've touched on a lot of great points here and good fundamental financial planning stuff. And it's nice to know that that happens in markets that maybe not everybody's exposed to. So thanks very much for sharing that. And thanks for doing the initial work on this too.
You're welcome to share the paper in your show notes if you'd like. Happy to have other people read and happy for feedback if there is any as well.
Perfect. Yeah, thanks very kindly, and have a great day then.
You as well.
Okay, probably one of my favorite things about that interview with Marshall is his complete willingness to disagree with me right from the beginning. I really appreciated that. I had a good laugh about that when I was listening to this to get everything ready. So the concepts that Marshall crossed that we haven't discussed yet, one of the things that came up in there was the concept of longevity insurance. And I'm going to, in the show notes, post up some stuff from Moshe Milevsky, and he talks about this concept of longevity insurance a fair bit. I think this is something we really have to consider in our financial planning or retirement planning discussions. This idea that we don't know how long our clients are going to live. It is possible that some of the clients that we see retiring today are going to live into their hundreds. So you get somebody retiring at age 65, you get somebody who lives until 105 or 110, that's as much time retired or even more time retired potentially than you spent working. Now, I do agree that spending is going to drop off in the years sometime after age 85, 90, thereabouts, depending how health holds up, but we do have to be prepared still that lifespan could go on for a very long time. The last thing we want is for our clients to run out of money when they're 90 or 92 or whatever the case, and find that there's still 10 or 15 years of decent health ahead of that person. So really, that idea of protecting against longevity, and this is something that Kent, I think, talked about a little bit as well in his discussion, where he talked about, you know, really getting the most value out of the retirement assets you've saved up and then dipping into Canada Pension Plan sort of as late as possible. Now, Marshall talked about the changes that are coming to the Canada Pension Plan here, and it was nice to hear him talk knowledgeably about the changes that are coming starting in 2019. I find a lot of people haven't paid a lot of attention to this. I do think this is something that we're going to see more questions about from clients now. I think the first place you're going to see it is with your business owner clients. Your business owner clients are going to see their cost per employee of contributing to Canada Pension Plan start to increase, and this is going to lead to questions. Basically, what's happened here is when the current federal government got elected, they looked at something that had happened in Ontario. Ontario has been dissatisfied, or at least the last Ontario government was dissatisfied with how the Canada Pension Plan would treat Ontarians. Basically, that YMPE number, that call it $57,400 for 2019, that figure doesn't quite cut it if you've got people who are located in the Golden Horseshoe area. Those folks are often earning substantially more than $57,400, so the CPP doesn't quite match up with the retirement realities we see. And Ontario actually had introduced its own pension plan, the ORPP, the Ontario Retirement Pension Plan, which was designed to give a little supplement to the Canada Pension Plan. When the current federal government got elected, they said, we're going to make it so Ontario can get rid of ORPP. We're going to enhance the Canada Pension Plan. We're going to make CPP more robust. And you can argue the merits of this. I don't want to get into a political discussion here. But basically what's happening here is the income that you contribute on is increasing. Now, this is a phased-in change. Today, the YMP is $57,400. By the time these changes have taken full effect, we will be actually using a different number. We'll be using the AMPE, the Adjusted Maximum Pensionable Earnings, which will be the YMPE plus an additional 14%. If we're looking at this in 2019 dollars, then today you would be contributing on $57,400. If the changes were fully in place, then you would be contributing on $65,436 or thereabouts. Of course, that's not going to be true until 2025. And this is one of the things that makes it challenging even talking about this concept, because by the time we get to 2025, inflation will, of course, have driven all of these numbers up. If we assume a 2% inflation factor, then YMPE in 2025 will be around $64,600, and AMP will be around $73,700. Now, the other thing that's changing here is the rate of contributions. And I mentioned this earlier in the podcast. We are going to see the rate of contributions go up from its current, well, from what you would be familiar with from 2018, which was 4.95%. Right now, we're at 5.1%. And by time this is all done in 2025, it'll be 5.95% on your income up to YMPE. And then what the government is suggesting, although this is not written in stone yet, is that it'll be 4% on your income between YMPE and AMPE. That's going to increase the cost of participating. Today, the cost to participate in the Canada Pension Plan for somebody who makes at YMPE or greater is around $5,400. By the time this is all said and done, that rate will be around $6,400. Those are all in 2019 dollars. Again, we'd have to adjust that for inflation. The benefit here, the benefit will increase then from the roughly $14,000 a year that it is today to about $21,000 a year. Now, that's not really going to help folks who are closer to retirement. If you're age 60 in 2025, you'll have contributed to Canada Pension Plan at lower rates for the vast majority of your working life, you'll see very little impact on your Canada Pension Plan for the sort of last 6 years that you contributed at those higher rates. Whereas, if you've got somebody who just turns 25 in 2025, when that person retires way down the road, they are going to have a CPP benefit, ignoring inflation, that's around $21,000 a year, about 1.5 times what it is right now. Marshall referred to some statistics and some information in that interview, and I wanted to include in the show notes some information to help you out with this. So I'm going to include in the show notes the quarterly information card for the Canada Pension Plan. It's quite good. And I'll also include the PDF document that Marshall had referred to that shows where the breakdown happens between early and late CPP. He did mention that it would be nice to know, and I agree with him, that it would be nice to know how many people are taking CPP early versus how many take it at age 65 and how many take it at age 70. I looked around quite a bit for that actual data, and I couldn't find that actual data. I read a fair bit of background information on the Canada Pension Plan looking for it. ESDC, Employment and Social Development Canada, has a lot of stuff on their website. What I ultimately am going to use as a proxy for the thing Marshall said he wished that we could get access to is on the quarterly information rate card, we can see that about 62% of current CPP recipients, so folks who are retired and collecting CPP, are also participating in the post-retirement benefits. That's about two-thirds of folks who would be probably in that category between age 60 and 65. And this is where we have to make some assumptions, but in that category between 60 and 65, where they are collecting CPP and still paying into the post-retirement benefit, that's probably a pretty good proxy for determining how many people would be collecting CPP early. I think you would find a very low proportion of people who are beyond the age of 65 and still participating in the post-retirement benefit. It does become optional at that point, and I think for most people it makes sense to opt out of PRB starting at age 65. I do think it's a good deal up until that point, though. That PRB might be a topic for a later podcast as well. We didn't even get into that here today. The number for today's episode is 2. The number for today's episode is 2. You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College, bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up. And you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way. Okay, I hope that's a good look at the Canada Pension Plan. There's lots there. We didn't even talk about CPP disability benefits in great detail, and that's a fascinating topic unto itself. Get into that in more detail in a later podcast. That's a good one for lots of client scenarios. I see lots of scenarios where CPP disability benefits are a big question. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time when we have a behavioral finance recording coming up where we're going to hear from Melanie again. Some of you remember Melanie is one of our guests from week one, and we're going to hear from Russ for the first time. And both of them have some fairly interesting takes around behavioral finance. We'll see this topic, and some of you probably aren't even familiar at all with behavioral finance, so this might be an introduction for some of you to the topic. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. This podcast was presented by Jason Watt. Production and music were provided by Joseph Tong.